What if you could help others to find the power to heal themselves? Physically, emotionally, and spiritually.
When I started teaching my classes, it was in 2002, and I was just doing the past life regressions and contacting the subconscious part. But then as the time went on and we found how powerful this was and what we could do with it, a lot of the students began saying, you know, advanced past life regression doesn't really tell what it's all about. This is so much more than that. We think you should change the name. So it was a few years ago, we decided to change the name to Quantum Healing Hypnosis Technique. And this is the healing technique that we've now been teaching it, well, since 2002, that's 12 years.
What if you could time travel with them? Visit mythical places or angelic realms, other worlds, other galaxies. Help others to speak to their higher selves. You can. Dolores has taught thousands of people from across the world how to use QHHT, and now you can learn her method by going directly to DoloresCannon.com. And don't forget to mention the discount code MORETALKS.
Established over 100 years ago, Watkins Books is one of the world's oldest and leading independent bookshops specializing in esoterica. We have the widest selection of esoteric books in the UK, and our friendly and knowledgeable staff are here to assist you in a unique ambience of our shop. So come and visit us in the heart of London as we're open every day.
The More Show is supported by Mindscape, Paranormal and UFO Matrix magazines, available for download on all major digital platforms.
If you like what you watch, then don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter for the latest updates on The More Show. Remember to subscribe to our YouTube channel for new weekly television and radio shows.
The comments and views expressed on The More Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the view of Kevin Moore, The More Show, or this radio station and its affiliate or sponsors. This show is for entertainment purposes only.
Broadcasting from the UK and across the world online, you're now watching the UK's only alternative late-night talk show, and I'm Kevin Moore. For the next hour, I'll be covering subjects that will open up your mind and provide you with information you may have never heard before. On today's show, I'm about to be joined by my guest, Art Markman. Now, Art Markman is Professor of Psychology and Marketing at the University of Texas, Austin. He is also the founding director of the Program in Human Dimensions of Organizations. The HDO program brings the human ties and the social behavior sciences to people in business. Art's research explores thinking. He has studied the way people form and use analogies, the mechanisms of decision-making, the modes that allow people to form a categories, and the influences of motivation on reasoning. Art is also the executive editor of the Journal of Cognitive Science and is a former executive office of the Cognitive Science Society. Art has also been interested in bringing insights from cognitive science to a broader audience. To that end, he writes for blogs for many websites including Psychology Today and Fast Company. He consults for companies interested in using cognitive science in their business. Art is also on the scientific advisory board for the Dr. Phil Show and the Dr. Oz Show. Along with Bob Duke, Art hosts the radio show Two Guys on Your Head for KUT Radio in Austin. Two Guys on Your Head is available as a podcast on iTunes and SoundCloud, and you can also follow the show on Twitter. Art Markman, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to have you on. It really is. Now, just for the audience and for myself as well, just if you just give us a bit of background on yourself and leading up just to your latest book as well, if possible.
Sure. So I'm a cognitive psychologist. So I study the way people think. And that's really dangerous because, of course, you sit down on an airplane next to somebody, you tell them you're a psychologist, and their initial reaction is that you're analyzing them. And I have to patiently explain that I actually don't care about their problems. What I care about is what is it that drives people to do what they do? How do they make decisions? How do they reason about things? How are they motivated to do things? I do a lot of studies that get read by 30 of my closest colleagues out there in the research literature. I've been doing that a long time, written a bunch of those. I've been a professor at a bunch of places, worked at Northwestern University for a while, Columbia University in New York. Here I'm here at the University of Texas in Austin now. I've been here about 18 years. It occurred to me starting, about 10, 12 years ago, that in addition to writing these papers that get read by my colleagues, that almost everybody I know has a mind, and almost nobody knows how it works. And that if people understood more about the way that their mind works, the way that they think, the way that they act, they might actually live their lives in a somewhat different way. And so in addition to continuing to do the research that I do, I began to do a little bit more work reaching outward to help people understand a little bit more about minds. And that led me in all kinds of directions. I am a blogger for Psychology Today, for Fast Company. I do an advice column on Fast Company. I have a radio show out of Austin, Texas called Two Guys on Your Head, which is sort of like car talk, but for the mind. In addition to that, I work with companies who want to bring cognitive science into what they do. And I've written several books, and those include the most recent book, which is called Smart Change, which is really focused on how to help people change behavior.
So where does consciousness fit into your work as well? Because obviously it's very much mind orientated, but obviously, do you believe that we're more than our mind? Do you think that there's a consciousness there? And what part does that play as well in these habits and decision making?
Well, I think that one of the fascinating things about the mind is that we have both a lot of experiences that are conscious and a lot of them that happen below the level of our awareness altogether. And that part of the problem that we have is that our conscious experiences often tell us to do things that our mind doesn't seem to listen to very much. I mean, anyone who's struggled with trying to change their behavior has had that situation where consciously they're saying, I've got to change. I've got to stop doing this. And yet they keep being drawn back into the same situations that they've been in the past. And so a lot of times what happens is we put people in a situation in which they end up fighting themselves because their conscious mind is saying, I gotta make these changes. And their unconscious mind is driving them back into the same situations that they've been in before. And a lot of what I'm interested in doing is helping people to stop fighting against themselves, which will allow them to align a lot more of the role of their conscious experiences in driving the actions that they really want to perform.
In the circles that I've interviewed as well, it's a whole range of different people, and some of the people that I've interviewed would say that some of the habits that we've got or that the issues that we have could relate back to past lives as well. Now, I know that's probably not in a field that you've ever come across, or maybe it is, but tell me, have you come across this, and what do you think of people like that?
Well, look, it's the problem is it's very hard to gather evidence from where a lot of our behaviors come from, because what we know is as an adult, by the time you've developed habits, you have no idea where they emerged from, and so those past lives could be just the life you had as a child. If people go into therapy these days, their therapist starts asking them from the very beginning all about their parents. Why do they care about your parents? It's not some weird thing where they're trying to figure out how you were toilet trained. It's because even things that happened when you were 2 years old, patterns of interaction that you had with your parents, with your siblings, influence your communication patterns and your habits as adults. Well, it's hard for us to provide evidence for exactly how those early experiences are affecting later behavior. So who am I to say exactly where the collection of habits that you have ultimately emerged from. And in many cases, at least from my standpoint, it doesn't even matter that much. What we know is you've got a set of action patterns, and you're going to have to change them somehow. And you know, if you make the decision that, you know what, they came from when I was a child, or, you know, even if you believe, look, they came from some past life, you have two options at this point. Either you decide to be a prisoner of that past experience, no matter how far back it falls, or you decide there's something you can do about that now. And if you're in the latter camp, then, you know, then bring it on. Let's figure out how to move people forward.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, what can some of these habits that you deal with, how can they, what are some of the habits that really restrict us that you see as common among people?
Well, I think that the way to say this is, people are so strongly driven by what feels right in the short term rather than what feels what is appropriate for them to do in the long term, which is why, you know, that piece of cake sitting in front of you is so tempting compared to, you know, looking great on the beach next summer, or you know, this really attractive person who comes up to you provides a temptation against a long-term relationship that you might have. You know, we were talking offline before we started about the Ashley Madison hack. Well, you know, I mean, sites like that are providing, you know, short-term temptations against long-term goals. So we see it there. We see it in spending behaviors. You know, people end up spending huge amounts of money that they don't have at the moment, and facilitated by credit cards and all kinds of things. So, you know, there's all sorts of temptations in our current world. You know, for some people, it's just email, right? We have all these things we'd like to accomplish. People want to write a book. People want to make a difference in the world. And then they spend their day sitting on Facebook and answering email. All of these things are short-term draws on your time. And the way that you can figure out that you've got a bad set of habits is when you are systematically failing to get things done in your life. So if you look at your life and you think, you know, there's this thing I really wanted to do and I'm just not getting it done, well, that's the point at which you need to be looking at your habits and figuring out what's getting in the way of that. As opposed to the kind of common failure that most of us have. You know, we lead busy lives, and there's a limited amount of time and money and energy. And so there are going to be days where, you know, like I play the saxophone, and I still take lessons. You know, there are weeks I don't make it to my saxophone lesson because I got other stuff to do. As long as I get there eventually, you know, then I realize that missing it every once in a while is a part of life. That's
sure.
Unsystematic failure. Unsystematic failure is good. Systematic failure is bad.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and that's a good example as well, that is. What about habits that can cause us to be unhappy, though? What about issues with unhappiness, and how does that come into your work as well, to be able to sort of
sure.
fix that?
Oh, yeah. Listen, I mean, I would say that part of what happens is when people end up pursuing a lot of these short-term draws on their behavior, they often end up feeling unfulfilled. Right? Because if you look back at what is it that makes you, happiness is a funny thing, right? I mean, we, you know, happy, but I think really what a lot of us are searching for isn't so much happiness as a sense of fulfillment or joy in life. And a lot of that really comes from our ability to do things in the long term that are fulfilling for us. Having a good relationship with family and friends and loved ones, really accomplishing something that we think is important. That requires sustained effort. And I think that one of the things that to me that happens is that people who are systematically failing to do those big picture items, they end up feeling unfulfilled in their lives. They may have brief moments of happiness, but they don't wake up in the morning and feel like their life is adding up to something bigger than the collection of some of the moments. And so to me, finding ways to align your day-to-day activities with the really big picture things you want to accomplish, that's the route to really feeling a sense of fulfillment in the life that you have.
So almost like having a focus and driving yourself towards that focus.
That's right. And helping yourself to eliminate some of the distractions and other things that are consistently getting in the way of allowing you to do that.
Well, that's so true, because when you make a choice in life sometimes, it's as if life tests you to truck everything opposing that choice for you really say, well, is this really what I want?
That's right. And so the funny thing is, people will sometimes give the excuse, well, if I gave into this, that long-term thing must not have been that important. But actually, the problem is those big picture items, they are deeply important to you. They are the things that are going to give you that long-term sense of fulfillment. The problem is, because of the way we're wired, and we really are wired to do the thing that feels right in the short term, this isn't a new problem. Sometimes I say this, people say, well, isn't that just the modern world that we're into instant gratification? And I like to point out that if you look at the Ten Commandments, right, they're all about doing the thing that's right in the long term rather than the thing that's right in the short term. And I bring those up because that's an old document, right? I mean, these were laid down 2,600 years ago, and people were struggling with that then, right? So for thousands of years, humanity has struggled to do the thing that's right for them in the long term rather than the thing that's right for them in the short term. And so those temptations that leap out, you need to be ready for those. You need to have a plan for how you're going to deal with those situations before they happen, so that you can put yourself on a path to doing that stuff that's right for you in the long term.
But surely, you know, when we go with the mind, most times it gives us unhappiness. When we go with the heart, it's as if our soul's talking to us, which is our true calling. What would you say to that?
Well, what I would say is that if you think about the mind, right, we have both an ability to rationalize things, to use language to cover over the emotional component of things, but we also have these emotional experiences. And emotional experiences emerge out of whether we're achieving our goals or not. At the point where you begin to consistently go against what your motivational system is telling you to do, you are setting yourself up for frustration and potentially unhappiness. I do this radio show that I mentioned, Two Guys on Your Head, and my yes. partner in crime on that show is a guy named Bob Duke. And one of the phrases that he trots out a lot on the show that I really like is that he points out that when you're making decisions, that really good decisions ought to both think right and feel right.
So it's both, right?
You want to be able to give a justification for what you're doing and know why you're doing it, but you don't want to have that be the sole reason you're doing it. You also want it to feel like something that that you should be doing. Right. And in those situations where you're both following your mind and your heart, you end up going in great places.
Yeah, because I mean, I've met people in my life, and they've always, you know, those who not seem to have made it, but have made choices which have been productive for them and actually worked out for the best, have always said to me, Kevin, I always follow my gut instinct. I always follow my heart. I listen to my gut instincts. But I'm sure that obviously they apply the mental side as well. And I like what you're saying there. Apply both. Don't miss one out over the other. Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right, because, you know, part of the problem is there are times where we also we're about to follow our heart into heartache, you know, where there's just something we want.
But we never listen though, do we?
And well, yeah, sometimes we do. You know, that's the problem, right? There are times where we manage to dash ourselves against the rocks because we really follow something that seems very exciting and wonderful, but know that there's a problem, you know, out there in the long run. And I think that oftentimes there are also things that we know will really be good for us. And we feel that, but we also can think about how that's going to help us in the long run. You know, the people who are happiest in life, if you think about work, for example, you know, we spend 40, 50 hours a week at work. You know, that's an awful lot of our week. And the people who are happiest are the ones who wake up in the morning and they are excited to go to work, both excited emotionally and also mentally, right? They want to engage with the great thoughts. And I'm sure you have that experience of loving the kinds of things that you do. You know, in the U.S., I say that the four saddest letters in the English language are TGIF, right? Because, you know, thank God it's Friday. I mean, anybody who feels like they're living their life just so that they can get to 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon so that they can hit the pub or, you know, go out with their friends, and life is going to begin at 5 o'clock on Friday and it's going to end on 9 o'clock on Monday morning again, that's a miserable place to be. And so aligning the head and the heart with where you want to be in the long term, that's the path to that kind of fulfillment.
And do you think the reason why people are in that negative state sometimes is that they don't listen to either the heart or the head, and most importantly, they're living in fear. They're coming from fear. It's a fear base that got them in there in the first place. And do you also think, as your work is based around some of the law of attraction stuff from what I've read, I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth there, but it seems to be some of it, in the sense that we create our reality.
I think we do create our reality. I think where I part company with the law of attraction stuff is that I actually think we need to be very aware both of what's going to go right in our lives as well as what's going to go wrong. That is, positive thinking alone is actually not going to get us where we need to be, in part because there are going to be things that can go wrong. There are going to be obstacles that are in our way. And if we don't want to allow, where I think that the idea behind the law of attraction is right, is we don't want to allow ourselves to be, our lives to be guided by those obstacles. There are a lot of people who look at the obstacles in front of them and think, you know, I can't do this. We don't want to do that. What we do want to do is to be aware of the obstacles that face us. Be aware that, you know, this job that I want to take may require some serious education. I may need to get out there and work hard. That this thing that I want to do may require money for me to do it, and I may need to make that money or find investors. You know, there are real obstacles. Nobody hands you anything. Sometimes if you work hard, good things also begin to happen because you are prepared for those good things to happen, but you need to be aware of what can go wrong. So to me, you know, I agree with what you're saying about, you know, the danger of fear. So I think there are a lot of people who don't try things because they're afraid that they might fail at them. And I think that what we need to do is to change our orientation to failure. You know, part of the problem we have is if you look at most of us, we've grown up in education systems where the primary thing that our education system teaches us is never make mistakes. So if you know, from your first day of school, you know, they start teaching you things and then they give you tests. And if you get an answer wrong on the test, they take points off, your mark goes down. Well, what is that teaching you? It's teaching you that successful people are successful because they minimize the number of mistakes that they make. If you look out in the world, that's not true. Successful people in the world make all kinds of mistakes, but then they learn from them. They realize, you know what, this didn't go well, so I'm gonna try this something in a different way next time. People who are successful in the world take risks. They Yes. try something because they're excited about it and it might work. And maybe and most people don't fail spectacularly. They fail moderately. You know, they don't necessarily succeed to their wildest dreams, but they learn something about how to do it better next time. And then they succeed the next time a little bit better and the next time a little bit better. And by being willing to put themselves out there, by being willing to take risks on things, they put themselves in a situation in which the good things that might happen in this universe are things that they're now open to. I mean, you know, a lot of times people will look at somebody who's been successful and say, you know, that person's really lucky because this happened to them and this happened to them and this happened to them. But you know what? Almost all of us have people who come into our lives who could potentially have been a great benefit to us. And most of us aren't open to the opportunity to allow ourselves to engage with those people because we're so worried about failing that we don't even try.
Yeah, well, my acronym of fear is, you know, false evidence appearing real. It's not always what you think it is. And I think in the respect to the law of attraction, or, you know, you create your reality, put law of attraction one side, that you create the reality that you're in. It also means you can uncreate it as well and have the life that you want. And I also think as well that when we go with what we feel is right and logically with what we could work out as well mentally, in a sense, if we do apply what you're saying and apply both, it always will lead us to where we need to be. So it might be what we think where we need to go is not actually what we end up with, but it's for our best that we end up with what we have, because it's
that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. It's funny. I in the book, in Smart Change, one of the things I talk about is, it is important to plan. It's important to have a plan for how you're going to approach your goals. But that plan should never be set in stone. So I think one of the things that, so you want to be prepared because there will be obstacles that will come in your way. Sometimes you don't realize all of the steps that are required to succeed. You know, for you to develop a successful show, for example, there's all sorts of things you had to do. Many of them are small details that someone who's trying to do this for the first time would never think of. And so you have to have that plan. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you can't believe that your plan is going to work in exactly the way that you think it's going to work, which means that you want to live your life as a process and not live it in the hope of a particular outcome. So one of the things I talk about in the book is that the goals that you have should be process goals, not outcome goals. Because if you envision an outcome and you decide that's the only acceptable outcome, then if you fail to achieve that outcome, you're unhappy. You feel like you failed. But if you decide that what you're going to do is to live your life according to a particular process, these are the things I'm going to do each day. These are the kinds of people I'm going to put myself into contact with. Yes, I have some desired outcomes, but if the world turns out to be slightly different than I thought it was going to be, and I end up in a slightly different place than I thought I was going to be in, I could still end up being really fulfilled by that because I was really engaged in a process that I believed in throughout. And so I completely agree with you. It's very dangerous to have a preconceived idea of exactly where your life needs to end up, where the only way you could be happy is if you hit that target. Right? Think about the difference between, so you've got somebody let's take the bow and arrow analogy to its absurd but logical conclusion. If I decide that the only way that I can be happy is to hit the bullseye, there's a distinct possibility I'm going to be unhappy. But if I get to the end of the day and say, you know what, I just spent a day shooting arrows, I might be a happy person, even if, what I ended up hitting that day wasn't quite the bullseye that I intended to.
That is so true. That is so true. And a lot of people as well will, that bullseye sometimes has to be the money.
That's right.
They may be doing what they like or enjoy, they think they enjoy, but it's all really comes down to they want to manifest that money. And there's nothing wrong with that because we all should be abundant with that which we wish to have. We have a right to have what we want, I think, in this world. But I think when it comes to really manifesting the money, I think you've got to, like you say, be flexible in the outcome of what it is you might actually end up doing. And I think the most important thing as well is, because life's never a straight road, but one of the most important things I think as well in the whatever it is you're offering, product or service out there that you're trying to get to, is it's got to be of service to people. How important is that in what you come across with what people do? It has to be of service.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think one of the things that we can get caught up in is assuming that our happiness reflects a situation that involves only our life. If I had this money, if I had this house, if I had this car, I would be happy. And one of the things we need to remember is that human beings are a social species, right? We are we survive because of our connection to the people around us. I always like to say, pick your favorite athlete. Big, strong athlete. Put that athlete up against a bear. My money's on the bear every single time. Where we succeed as humans is not by being imposing individuals, but by being connected in a social structure. Now, one of the ways that our brains drive us to do that is that we are happiest when we are connected to the people around us. And those connections are two-way connections. That is, we can't just draw the energy from everyone else. We have to give back energy. And of course, to use this kind of a metaphor of energy, it turns out there isn't necessarily a fixed amount of that energy. If I draw energy from you and I give back, we're actually able to increase the overall amount of energy that's out there. And so our brains are wired to make us most happy, most fulfilled, and most satisfied when we are connecting with the people around us. And so by doing things of service to the people in our community, we are actually increasing that energy that's available and really making our lives better in the service of making everybody else's lives better. And so, you know, there's nothing, I agree with what you say, there's nothing wrong with wanting for yourself. But it's the recognition that the best path to getting the things that you want for yourself is to connect with the people around you. That once you learn that lesson, then you actually are on a much a path that's much more likely to lead to the happiness that you want.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, actually, the way you just said it there. You know, it's almost like, you know, we are all connected at some deeper level that we cannot explain on, even in words, in a sense. And when you apply that, you know, of being of service, and you could say that most jobs are of service, you know, the hairdresser's of service, you know, whatever, you know, the guy serving in the canteen, you know, is of service.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's coming from that space, and when you're deciding what to do, that you are coming from that space to make sure you are, because when you put others first, you put yourself first, and when you put yourself first, right. You put others first. It's a bit of an enigma sometimes, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. You know, there's a great old story about you know, to talk about this idea that it can really be any job. It doesn't. And there's a great old story about John F. Kennedy visiting NASA, and he's walking around NASA, and he bumps into a guy who's a maintenance guy who just, you know, cleans the place up, and he says to him, "So what do you do here?" And he says, "I'm sending a man to the moon," right? And I mean, that's it, right? It's at the point where you recognize that whatever it is that you're doing, that it's part of a larger reality, it's part of a larger set of goals. It doesn't necessarily matter the particular role you're playing. When you understand the way that you're connected to something much bigger than yourself, that puts you in a situation that can give you a much more fulfillment in the work that you're doing.
Absolutely, absolutely. So just to sort of refocus then back on the book, because there's a reason for covering that stuff there, because some of this is where some of these habits can lie as well. So, you know, there's, you know, just to sort of put a bit of groundwork there. But with yourself, you know, you've got the motivational system you've set up as well, but you've got the go system, I believe, and the stop system. So just explain a bit about that to the audience as well.
Yeah, sure. So one of the things that I tried to do in Smart Change is to say, look, if you really want to change those habits, one of the things that you need to do is to understand more about the way that your brain operates, because a lot of times we do things to work against our brain. So what we have to understand about the brain is that really deep inside the brain are these structures that are part of circuits that engage the goals that you have, that give those goals some energy and drive you to act. Okay, some of those goals are just goals that I may adopt right now, but many of those goals are the habits that I have. And those habits are essentially memories of past actions that I've taken. Okay, that go system is very powerful, and it really drives us to act all the time. Now, every once in a while, you realize there's something you do that you don't want to do anymore. So, you know, someone might start smoking at the age of 18, and in their 30s, they realize, you know, this is not a sustainable behavior for me. It's time for me to stop smoking. And they start by saying, you know, I need to stop doing this. Well, we have another system in the brain that involves the frontal lobes of the brain, which are right up, you know, there's some areas right above your eyes. And those areas of the brain are part of what I call the stop system. And the stop system is there so that when your go system engages a goal, like to smoke a cigarette, that stop system says, no, I don't want to do that. Now, the problem with the stop system is that while it functions reasonably well most of the time, it can be impaired by stress, by drugs and alcohol, by overuse. Which is why, you know, if somebody's a really stressful day, you'll see them run outside to smoke a cigarette. Or, you know, if they, you know, people who've completely stopped smoking and then they have a couple of pints too many and now they're outside having a cigarette. Or they've spent that whole day controlling themselves at work and not telling their boss, you know, what they really think of them. And now, you know, at the end of the day, they're like, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to do the wrong thing. So here's the problem. When I want to change my behavior, a lot of times what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, I need to stop doing this thing that I do. You can't frame your behavior change negatively like that, because when you frame it negatively, what you're doing is relying on the stop system to do all the work for you. The only successful route to changing your behavior is to reprogram that go system so that you are now engaging better goals, goals that are better aligned with what you want to do in the long term. And so it means don't say, I'm going to stop smoking. Figure out the situations where you smoke and start doing something else in those situations. Find positive actions you can perform, because it turns out that your brain doesn't learn not to do things. Because if you think about it, you're constantly not doing things. So how do you instead create a new set of behaviors that you're going to perform repeatedly that are going to become the new habits of your life? And so if you reorient the way you think about changing your behavior from here's a bunch of things I do that I'm going to stop doing to here's a bunch of things that I'm going to start doing in my life that are positive things, whether it involves smoking or it might involve the way you eat, it might involve the way you act at work, it might involve what you choose to do for work altogether. Getting back to some of the things we were talking about, if your goals really involved greed and getting things for yourself, then maybe the actions you need to perform involve reaching out to the people around you and making connections. Those are also positive actions you can perform that will eventually themselves become habits. So it's reprogramming that go system that is really central to the approach that I take to trying to help people to change.
Right. So not going too much, focusing on the stop system. But in a sense, just going back to the smoking, I suppose, you could say to yourself, okay, well perhaps I'm going to join the gym. So that behavior then, you'd say to yourself, okay, well, if I'm going to join the gym, I can only do so much cardio without stopping smoking and cutting that down slowly.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So now I'm doing positive things that are getting in the way of the behavior I don't want to do anymore.
Absolutely. And, with people's goals then, how can the sort of success of their goals, be affected by their behavior as well, in a sense?
Yeah. So the thing is, just having a goal doesn't get you anywhere, right? That there are lots of people we know who have lofty goals. This is the thing I want to do. The next step is to take those goals and turn them into specific actions that you're going to perform on a daily basis. So, the thing you can see, and you must have the opportunity to interview all sorts of very successful people. And I think one of the things we can say about successful people is they do things. They don't just say they're going to do things. They don't just think about cool things they're going to do. They do them. Which means that on a daily and weekly and monthly basis, they are taking actions that are bringing them steps forward towards where they would like to be in their lives. They are active in doing that. And so one of the big things about changing behavior that's so important is how do we go from just having this idea, here's something I'd like to accomplish, to actually creating a plan that makes its way onto your daily schedule. And that schedule doesn't have to be, you don't have to have like a Google calendar for that schedule, though some people may, right? But it has to be something specific enough that each day you're actually doing something in service of your long-term goals. You can't just wait for things to happen, And I think that one of the most important things to do is to be willing to be active, to recognize where the obstacles are so that you are ready to avoid them, to walk around them, to ensure that they don't happen. And then to get back to something we were talking about earlier, to be willing to take some risks, to potentially fail in our first attempt to make a change in our behavior. I think a lot of people, they're willing to try up to the first time that they fail, and they go, it's not for me, I can't do this. And I don't know a single successful person, I mean really successful person, who didn't fail the first time that they tried the thing that they were doing. It's that willingness to pick yourself up and dust yourself off and get back to it, but try it a different way, learn from the mistake. recognizing and to reach out to people around you. You know, one of the other things I talk about in the book a lot is the importance of that social environment, not just to be of service to people, but to learn from people. You know, I tell a story in the book about, you know, in Austin, Texas, we have a deer problem. We have lots of deer who live in the forests around town. And of course, we've built houses into all of the woods here. And so the deer come wandering into the neighborhoods. And what happens is these deer are born on your yard, and within a day they run off with their moms. And I was struck by this because I have three kids, and two of them are 21 now, and one of them is 18. And in one way or another, I'm still supporting all of them. You know, so why is it that a baby deer within a year can be a fine, upstanding member of the deer community, and entering a third decade of life, I still have kids who are just about on the fringes of being able to make a contribution to society? And the answer to that is deer are stupid, right? Deer don't know what to do in the modern world, and so they can't get out of the way of moving cars, and if their food supply is short, they can't run to the supermarket. And kids grow up in an environment in which they are being taught so much by the people around them. And so they learn how to navigate the world as it is right now, even though that world doesn't resemble what the world looked like 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. We have to be willing to keep doing that. We have to be willing to continue learning from the people around us about how to succeed in our lives, which means looking around and finding people who have the life you want, and then reaching out to those people and finding out how did they do it, and being willing, you know, a lot of people have too much pride to ask for help, but you can't do these things alone. You have to be willing to reach out and say, help me. How did you do that great thing that you learned how to do? Because I'd like to do that. And if you reach out to people and you learn from them and you allow yourself to be carried along by the people who've already found some ways to succeed, it brings you along further. It allows you to accomplish things you never thought you'd be able to do. And then at some point, it gives you the opportunity to turn around and serve as a mentor for other people, right? Mm-hmm. To really be able to help them. And when we talked about fulfillment, one of the most fulfilling things you can do is not just to begin to succeed yourself, but then to turn around and give a hand to the people who are behind you, who also want that success, and to lift them up. Because, you know, sharing that success with others is such a wonderful way to really feel that fulfillment in life.
Yes, yes, and when you do that as well, to know that there's enough out there to share as well.
Exactly. There is enough. It's not a zero-sum game.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And when we do find ourselves falling a bit behind, or the temptations have come in strong, and we've, you know, whatever, just going back to the smoking thing as well, you know, we've had a few cigarettes where we shouldn't have done. We shouldn't be horrible to ourselves, should we? Because our worst enemy sometimes is ourselves. What should we do? What steps could we take?
Yeah, so I think one of the things we have to recognize is there's a lot of people who divide the world into black and white, and you're either on the good side or you're on the bad side. And so when you take cigarette smoking, you know, they'll say, well, I smoked for years, now I'm going to stop. So I went from being a smoker to being a non-smoker. Well, you know what? If you have one of those days where you end up having a cigarette for whatever reason, you don't want to look at that and say, oh, I've now crossed the line back from being a non-smoker to being a smoker. So now I'm a smoker again. So I may as well go out and buy a carton of cigarettes and smoke 5 packs in the next 3 days. You know, instead, take a step back and say, yeah, all right, you know, probably shouldn't have done that. What went wrong? Oh, I know what happened. I was hanging out with my friend John. My friend John is always getting me to head out with him and have a cigarette. You know what? I love John. I'm going to still hang out with him. But the next time that he heads out for a cigarette, this is what I'm going to do instead. You know, and have a plan for that and know what you're going to do before you get into that situation. So now the next time you face that situation, you don't fail again. And if you don't treat the world as completely black and white, if you recognize that there are going to be days, you know, behavior change is 2 steps forward and 1 step back. And as long as that 1 step back doesn't become 3,000 steps back, you're okay. You're still moving forward. So how do you allow yourself to say, okay, I did the wrong thing. I'm going to feel a little bit bad about that. Nothing wrong with feeling a little bad. Sometimes bad feeling is helpful for us. But okay, enough of that now. What am I going to do differently next time? How am I going to be better the next time?
Yes, absolutely. And I suppose as you're changing your behavior, your habits and everything, and for example, you might stop, you know, your drinking because maybe it was a bit excessive sometimes. Right. And that will stop when you're getting up early in the morning, whatever it may be, just to, you know, to make a productive day. You may find your circle of friends changing, and that could be quite scary as well, with who you're surrounded by. And, you know, you may not want to leave the life you've got, or you may be scared of entering into a new life.
Oh, I think that's right, and you have to own that. You have to recognize, you know what? I am nervous about this. I am, and recognize that we are most comfortable when we're doing what we've done in the past. That almost every time you step out to do something new, it's going to feel a little uncomfortable, and that's not necessarily a good reason not to do it. Right? Sometimes, you know, you have to say, okay, am I feeling bad about this just because it's new? Or is there something more there? And at the point where you realize that most of what's holding you back is just that you might end up doing something new, that's the point at which you have to just step forward, you know, and cast off some of the old things that you've done and be willing to step in and do something new. And you know, don't burn your bridges behind you. You know, so you might realize, you know what, it wasn't really my friends. You know, it wasn't really my friends that were holding me back. It was something else about me. So maybe you step away from them for 3 months or 6 months. But then, you know, if you've done it in a nice way, you can come back to them and say, you know what, maybe I might have been a bit of a jerk the last couple of months, but I was going through some things myself, and really I value your friendship and I value your role in my life, and I still want you in my life.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, obviously must have used some of the work that you've you know, that you're now publishing in this book. You know, you must have embraced it in your life as well, in a sense. And
yeah.
did you ever you know, in this process that you write about, you know, is it good to listen to sort of, you know, other motivational speakers, in a sense? Did you ever, you know, use that technique as well? Or
I guess I did in a slightly different way, which is, you know, I'm a psychologist. As I said at the open, right, I spent a lot of my life doing all this research and reading all of this research. And so, you know, if you look at the book, this book is a very science-based book. That is, I'm trying to say, look, here's really what we know about the way your mind works from the standpoint of the science of psychology and the science of neuroscience. But it's not just my work, right? I do refer to some of the studies that I've done. But if you look at the back, there's all kinds of references, and most of the research is stuff that other people did, you know, and I've learned a tremendous amount from other people. So and I think you have to be open to that. I don't think any of us has the only right way to do things and you know, is the only one who knows the truth. And so, yeah, we have to be willing to listen to the people around us. And who you choose to listen to depends a little bit on who you come into contact with and who you whose messages you resonate to. Because I'm already a scientist, it was easier for me to read the basic science papers. But there are a lot of great people out there who have wonderful messages that can be very inspiring but also very helpful. And yeah, I think you really do need to be open to being willing to look at the world in a different way.
Well, you know, you seem very open-minded. I've got to say that. And I mean, who are some of the non-scientific sort of studies that you've looked at that are sort of not on the fringe, but wouldn't be, you know, obviously included in the peers that you speak with, you know, in their
works?
Yeah,
well, you know, so for me, one of the things that I love to do is I love literature. So I have a lot of jobs in my life. I play music. I'm in a blues band on Sunday nights, you know. But I also run a program for people in business, which we call the Human Dimensions of Organizations. And the idea is we take the humanities and the social sciences and the behavioral sciences, and we bring those together to help people understand people. And so, you know, for me, you know, if we think about non-scientists, for example, you know, I think there's a tremendous amount in literature that involves stories of people struggling with their lives. You know, and one of the wonderful things about reading those books, you know, and at different times in your life, different pieces of literature will strike you. The beauty of reading those books is that they allow you to walk in someone else's shoes without actually having to go out and do some of those, the horrible things that other people may have done, or to go through those experiences. And so, you know, opening yourself up to reading, you know, and really experiencing things very different from your own life circumstance. I mean, that's been a powerful thing for me over the years, you know, and one of the reasons, you know, I mean, I love music and I love reading the biographies of musicians, because, you know, music has this wonderful way of allowing you to express things that language won't allow you to express. And to read the stories of you know, the Coltranes of the world, the, you know, Sonny Rollins and the great jazz, you know, musicians. And I'm a sax player, so I certainly, you know, those are people I resonate to. But to, you know, to read those stories, even Keith Richards' biography, right, had some wonderful moments in it in between the drug-induced haze. But when he was talking about the creation of the music, you know, those kinds of stories, even if you're not going to be a musician, oftentimes those teach you something about excellence. You know, I mean, if you think about someone like Coltrane, for example, who reached the pinnacle of his profession, even if you never hope to be a saxophone player, to read the story of greatness and to think about what someone had to internalize in order to do that can be inspirational in its own way, right? And I think that giving ourselves opportunities to put ourselves in other people's shoes is such a powerful way of helping us to influence our own behavior.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. You know, like you say, just to read those stories and to not have experienced it yourself, but to try to empathize and maybe try to feel what they had to go through. You know, when we turn around and say, "Oh, look, they've had it so easy. Look how successful they are. They've got life so." They don't know what they've had to go through or give up or lose to get to that point, and the struggles that they went through. You know,
right.
It's so easy to judge, isn't it?
Yeah. And to learn about the ways that people seized opportunities. You know, a lot of times we have that what has become a trite phrase, right, to look for the silver lining in every cloud. But if you look at the stories of success, almost everyone's success story involves finding those silver linings and turning them not just into a silver lining, but turning them into a river of silver, right? They have taken what looked like a terrible situation and turned it into something that was life transforming for them. That is so pervasive in people's success stories. And it's so important for us because it helps us to remember that it's not fair to say everything wasn't handed to me, because the people who come into your life, even if they aren't giving you exactly what you want, may still have held the key to success for you if only you were open to taking it.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes our worst enemies are our best teachers.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And I suppose in the case of science as well, how much do we really understand about the brain, even up to 2015? I mean, what is there to? There must be so much to learn about. I mean, where does our consciousness come from?
Yeah, exactly. You know? Oh, listen. This is one of the last great mysteries, right? The brain is incredibly complicated. And it's what keeps me coming back to work every day. You know, I mean, in addition to doing this kind of writing and talking to people like you, I still do my science. You know, later today, I'm going to meet with one of my graduate students. We're going to talk about the studies that he's working on. And you know what? There's still so much to be learned. And that's wonderful. And to me, you know, the approach that I take as a scientist is a multidisciplinary approach. There isn't a single right way to learn about the way that brains and minds work. We have to think about them from a psychology standpoint, from neuroscience, from anthropology, and even literature, right? All of these things have something to teach us about the way human minds work as individuals, as groups, as cultures. And if you don't have that level of openness, you can't possibly understand the most complex problems that face us.
Well, no, you know, the more that I've sort of embraced the idea that, you know, we can create our reality. Funny enough, these past few months, you know, I've just been manifesting one thing after another. Small things, but they've been happening. I've been writing things down saying, oh, yeah, I want that, I want that, I want that. And then, you know, somehow in ways that I couldn't see, they appear. And it's just been making me think really outside the box that, well, what if there's something bigger here? There's a bigger picture somewhere. And you know, consciousness is not located locally where we think it is. And actually, what we perceive to be real right now, maybe there may be something, a much bigger picture than all this. Or is that just woo-woo?
Well, I would say that we don't know. Right? I mean, the thing about consciousness, we know that brains create conscious experiences. Sure. And we know that human beings are a social species that require ourselves to be connected to each other. Those are some things we know. We don't know what causes our conscious states. We don't know all of the factors that bind people together. And it would be a mistake to close off avenues of inquiry just because they don't seem to make sense. So, you know, as scientists, the main thing that we agree is to be bound by data, meaning that at some point we're going to try and frame a question that we can get some data on. And if the data really strongly argue against something, then we probably shouldn't believe it. But you know, the history of science tells us over and over again that some of the things that we thought were completely loony ideas ultimately turned out to be right.
And
so you have to be open to recognizing that things that seem really loony to us right now may still be correct.
That's the crazy part of it, isn't it, in the sense? And what if the results didn't want to be known? What if consciously the results changed themselves because there was a desire for it not to be known? I mean, I know that sounds a bit mad, but I mean, what you know...
No, it certainly could happen. I mean, you know, I would say that at the moment, the mind has been fairly amenable to study. That is, you know, we have done a great job of understanding much more about the way human minds work. But one of the things that I want to point out about that is there are times where people say, well, you know, if we really begin to understand the way the mind works, isn't that going to take the mystery out of it? Isn't that going to take some of the beauty and the joy of being human out of it, because we will understand more of this, you know, if we understand. But I think the thing we need to recognize is that there are so many factors at play in the human experience that even though we understand more and more elements of the way that the brain works, the way the mind works, we still that doesn't change the nature of the first-person experience we have. You know, as I like to say, even a botanist loves getting flowers for Valentine's Day, right? Look, there are a lot of painters, for example, who deeply understand what is required to create beautiful visual experiences for people. The fact that they understand that does not change the fact that they can be incredibly emotionally moved by a piece of artwork. So understanding these things is not going to make them any less awesome in the kind of, you know, real meaning of the word.
No. And I mean, would it be a shock that perhaps one day when we get further into the understanding of the mind and consciousness, that it could go in a different direction to what even science could have predicted, in a sense?
Well, yeah, we have to be open to that, right? I mean, that's part of what it means to do science, is not to close things off just because they don't make sense to us in the situation we're in right now. Look, 3,000 years ago, if you said, no, actually, we're on a very small rock hurtling through space, you know, people would say, yeah, I don't think so. But we are, you know. And so, you know, science has constantly turned and overturned beliefs about our place in the universe. And I think that, you know, we have to recognize that there's, you know, science is a method. It doesn't prescribe what the answer is going to be.
Sure.
And so, you know, and that's one of the reasons that we need people to be thinking broadly about, you know, I mean, consciousness is such a mystery. We need people to be thinking broadly about what consciousness could be as a way of helping us to constrain ideas about that we could test about what it might be.
and what it could do in a way to bring us all together, in a sense, and to alleviate some of the issues that we have. And perhaps there's an easier way and less painful way to for a space to come from.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 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 What would you say then, obviously, because we're getting to the end of the interview here, it's been fascinating, by the way, Art, what would you say is one of the most important messages of your book?
I think the most important message is that we all have the capacity to reach our long-term goals. We can do the things that we want to do, but if we're going to do them, we need to learn a little bit about our minds. We need to understand a little bit more about who we are so that we can engage tools to help us to reach the potential that we have. And, you know, so my book, Smart Change, is one way of doing that. I want to, you know, what I try to do is teach you a little bit about the way your mind works, give you some very specific tools you can use to help you reach those goals. It's only one of many books that are out there that try to do that. And that if nothing else, you know, I mean, obviously it'd be wonderful if people checked out my book, but I think if people are just open to learning more about themselves and about how they can break out of the habits that are constraining who they are right now to move forward in their lives, by learning a little bit more about the mind, by learning a little bit more about what we know about success, then people can people will look back on who they were now from the vantage point of 2 years or 5 years from now, and realize how far they've come in doing new things.
And would you say that now is all we have, and not to look back too much on the past, and to really just say that this is the present moment? And this is what counts, not the future, but now. The changes we make now will affect the future.
That's exactly right. All we have at our disposal is now. And you know, we have to learn from the past. But as we said earlier, we can't be prisoners of the past. No matter how far that past extends for us, we have to allow ourselves to move forward from that.
Well, Art Markman, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a complete pleasure.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate the time to talk with you. This was great fun.
Well, we've come to an end on tonight's show. Don't forget that you can listen and watch all the past interviews on The More Show's official YouTube channel. Remember to subscribe to our YouTube channel for new daily shows. You may also find out more on all past and upcoming guests on The More Show by going to themoreshow.co.uk, and do like us on Facebook and Twitter for the latest updates. So until next time, be safe.